Hey, nurses! This National Nurses Week 2025, it's time to celebrate you, the backbone of healthcare, with a vacation you truly deserve. Join Nurse.com for a luxurious group cruise aboard Virgin Voyages, sailing May 9th through May 14th. It's a celebration like never before, designed exclusively for nurses. Picture this. Tranquil ocean views, world-class amenities, and the chance to connect with your nursing community while leaving the stress of long shifts far behind. Plus, when you join us, you'll receive $200 in onboard credit per cabin to enjoy spa treatments, premium excursions, merchandise, and more. You spend every day caring for others. Now it's your turn. Let's trade scrubs for sandals and sail into National Nurses Week with joy, connection, and well-deserved relaxation. Register now to join the group trip at nurse.com/cruise. That's nurse.com/cruise. We can't wait to celebrate you. Hey, nurses. Welcome to the Nurse Dot Podcast, giving nurses validation, resources, and hope one episode at a time. Today on Nurse Dot Podcast.
When you grow up in it, it's just your way of life. I didn't know that there would be any feelings to process. But if I look back with my mature eyes and I see my behavior showed that I did feel like I needed attention.
Joining us today, Dawn Lunsford. Not only is Dawn my incredible wife and producer of this podcast, but she is here to share her own unique perspectives as someone who has lived with terminally ill siblings and then went on to marry a nurse who coincidentally worked at the very hospital where both her sister and brother passed away. I'm your host, Kara Lunsford, registered nurse and VP of community at nurse.com. Dawn Lunsford.
I got the intro.
Also known as Wifey.
Hi, Wifey.
You are Wifey. Well, you have been behind the scenes doing all of the amazing audio and editing and the music and so much of the production of this podcast. But I am excited today to have you on the other side of the mic.
Yes, I'm excited to be here.
I interviewed your mom.
Yes.
And we talked about how she basically raised two terminally ill children with cystic fibrosis.
Yes.
And these two terminally ill children were your sister and brother.
Yes.
They were your older sister and your older brother.
Yes.
So you were the youngest.
I was the baby.
You were the baby. And as we were doing this interview, a few times it came up, you know, what your mom's perspective was on what it was like for you growing up in that household. But I think what was really interesting was that I think she wasn't entirely sure what it was like for you. She had an idea, and maybe it was even what she hoped it was like for you. But then it sparked the conversation of, well, let's ask you, what was it like growing up in a family where you're the youngest, you have two terminally ill siblings who you know you're going to experience their death at some point, and you are the only child that is healthy. So let's just go back. Let's just go back to like maybe your earliest recollection, maybe your earliest recollection of being the healthy child in that family.
Well, I do want to address one thing you just said, which is interesting. I did not grow up aware that my siblings had terminal illnesses. I read that and I found that out on my own, that there was no cure for cystic fibrosis. And when I read that, I was probably, I can't remember how old I was, but I certainly wasn't a little, I must have been close to teenage years or in my teenage years. And at first I felt very betrayed and left out and not included in the family. But as I got older, I realized, you know, at what point were my parents supposed to sit me down and go, hey, look, this is terminal. Also, you know, as being a parent now, at my age, I can see my parents, like all other parents of ill children, are hanging in there for some hope. Something will be discovered. Something will be developed. They could beat this. And they're dealing with their own struggle within themselves about, should I be grieving this or it's not here yet? Could there be a different outcome? So at what point do you sit your youngest child down and say, hey, look, this is what cystic fibrosis is, to prepare yourself? It's just not really an appropriate thing to do. So as a younger person, I might have felt left out of that information and angry about it. But as I matured, a lot of the things that, of course, I didn't understand as a child, I understand now as a grown woman who has a child of their own.
So that, I mean, that makes that I've been with you for 13 years and I didn't actually know that. I did not know that you were not aware of the terminal nature of your sibling's disease until you were in your teens. Now, your sister passed when you were five. Mm-hmm. So did your parents explain to you at all what happened for her? Or because your mom said it wasn't really the cystic fibrosis that took her, so that maybe there wasn't a reason to have that conversation?
Well, I didn't, you know, I knew my siblings had cystic fibrosis. I don't ever remember hearing the word hemangioma.
Hemangioma.
Yeah, hemangioma. I knew about the blood vessels on her hip and her butt cheek because, you know, as kids, we change our clothes, we talk about it, we joke about it, and we called it her strawberry. And so my parents tried to make it something, you know, lovely and beautiful. But I think that was even before they realized how much it was taking a toll on her heart. And I think eventually my parents, I think, tried to explain to me that her heart gave out, but they couldn't really explain it in a way that I was, you know, I was five. I didn't understand permanence. I didn't understand what death meant. You know, I just always assumed because I was capable of understanding that they both had cystic fibrosis. I kind of made the conclusion that that's what took her. It really wasn't until I was in my 50s when you were talking to my mom and my mom said, no, it was actually the hemangioma that took her. And I was like, oh, I had to wrap my head around that it wasn't cystic fibrosis. So that was new. I mean, which is not to say no one ever said it. I may have gotten that just stuck in my head and because I could understand
right.
it.
Right. Yeah. Well, that seems reasonable.
Yeah.
That you would tie it to the thing you knew. Mm-hmm. So there's a very interesting story to when your sister passed. And I actually would love for you to share that story because I think it's very telling as to the experiences that young children can have, especially around death. So the day of Laura's funeral, right? Mm-hmm. Or was it after? Was it after her funeral?
I feel like it was either right before or right after her funeral. It wasn't that long after her passing, but it was right in that transition time. We shared a room and I was sitting on the floor. We had hardwood floors and I was playing with toys. I was sitting cross-legged on the floor playing with deep in meditation with whatever toy I was playing with. And it was so quiet in the house and my back was to the door from the hallway. I was facing in towards the room and all of a sudden my sister said, hey. And I kind of looked up and saw her there. I mean, solid as a human being could be. And I just went back to playing and I went, what? You know, and she said, I have something to tell you. And it never occurred to me, like, how'd you get in the room? My back's to the door. It didn't occur to me that it was strange at all. Because I think kids, you know, especially me, I didn't have a whole lot of logic going on. It was really more imaginary. And I was in such a meditative state, as kids do when they're little and playing. And I said, well, what is it? She said, I have to tell you something. I said, okay. And she said, I can't come play with you anymore. And I said, why not? And I don't even think I was looking up at the time. I was continuing to play with whatever I was playing with, barely giving her the time of day. And she said, because I have to go be with God and the angels. And I said, why? And she said, because I just have to. Okay. Like an older sibling would just be annoyed with you. Like, don't ask me questions I can't answer. Just, I have to. Okay. And I said, well, when will I see you? Will I see you again? And she said, yes, I will see you again, but it's going to be a very, very long time. But we will play together again. It's just going to be a long time from now. And I said, okay. She said, I have to go, you know. And I'm like, okay. And I honestly don't even think I was really looking up. I was kind of half look. I'd look up at her. I'd glance up. And I'd look. But she was sitting there solid. And what's funny is in my memory now, now that I feel like I'm more tapped into energies and what was happening, I have this very, I can't describe it, but it's a sense. I didn't see this, but it was a sense that there was someone standing beside her that had brought her, almost like a guardian saying, I'm going to take you there and then I'm going to bring you back. You're going to be able to have this conversation and I'll take you. It was someone very tall and very authoritative, but I never saw that person. It was a feeling.
Wow.
And I never really mentioned that part of the story because it was, I'm just sort of processing that now and remembering that. And then all of a sudden, and I went back to playing, she was gone. It never occurred to me about the reality of walking in the room, walking out of the room or anything. My mom walked in. She said, hey, who are you talking to? Because as a strange child as I was and imaginative as I was, she never heard me really having a conversation like that when I'd play by myself. I might do little voices or something, but this was different. And she knew it. And she came and said, who are you talking to? And I said, oh, Laura was here. And she said, what did she say? And I told her, and you'd have to ask my mom what her perception was. She actually wrote a short story about the whole thing, and which is how I knew her side of it was when I read her short story, that she had heard me talking in the hall, opened the door and said, who are you talking to? And I think because I got to be the one in the family that had that experience being so young, so open, I got to have a sense of closure and a sense of peace around it that nobody else got to have.
Wow.
And so that was really a gift because I often went, gosh, have I grieved this enough? You know, have I gone back and processed? When someone can come back to you and say, don't worry, I'm fine. I just have to go here now, but I'll see you again. I promise. You know, it kind of makes you go, oh, okay. That's closure for me.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
And knowing that they're okay, you know, they're fine where they are. They're safe. They just have to go do this,
yeah.
You know? And as a child, you know, if you grew up any, even remotely adjacent to the idea of church, you don't question, you know, when God says you got to come be with God and the angels, you don't go, well, let's talk about that. You know, you just, you kind of go, well, that's the big authority. Okay. Sure.
I asked your mom about church and, you know, she had kind of said that, you know, you guys did go to church as kids. Do you recall going to church as kids?
I do. Yeah, I do. I'd kind of forgotten about it because my mom reminded me when I heard her interview that when we moved to the Valley from Gardena, we didn't really have a community of church anymore. So from like 9 or 10 on, my memory was that we didn't go to church. But when I was little, yes, I do remember having to wear those tight, awful, you know, shoes and white stockings, getting a 5-year-old or a 4-year-old into stockings and a dress and doing my hair. And I do remember, you know, we would all dress up for church and go to church. Yeah.
And I would say today that we're not necessarily church going people, but we're very spiritual. I mean,
I have a lot of respect for people who have some sort of faith, whatever they call it, and are devoted to their faith. Even if I don't call my faith their faith, I feel like I'm more connected to people who have some sort of faith that they follow than complete atheist who is, you know, although I have complete atheist friends, we get along. We just don't really talk about that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course. Kind of like pivoting for a second So this is kind of like your earliest experience, you know, as a five-year-old. Now you've dealt with end of life, loss, grief. What was it like for you having parents who were going through an immense amount of grief? Because it's pretty clear to me that you were able to have your own sense of closure, which was great. But then you have parents who are still responsible for taking care of you and also your brother, who had his own medical needs at the time. And he was, what was he, 15? He would have been 15 at that time. So maybe a little bit more independent. And it sounds like Mark was a pretty independent guy, but still had medical needs. And now your parents are in a tremendous amount of grief. What was that like? Do you remember? Do you remember what that was like for you? And do you remember how long that felt like it lasted for?
I think the process of losing my sister was very different for me as a witness to their grief as it was as my brother. I was very different ages. They were very different ages and different places in their processing. So when my sister passed, my two memories are I don't know where my dad went. In my memory, he disappeared somewhere, and I still to this day don't know where he went. And this is, you know, maybe this is something I'll ask my mom about at some point. But I asked him when we sat down and had a big talk one day, and I said, you know, when Laura died, where were you? All I remember is my aunts came coming over, neighbors coming over to console us, and I don't know where he was. I don't remember him. I don't have a memory. And so in my childlike mind, I kind of villainized him as abandoning my mother. Not abandoning me, but where were you, and why were my mom's sisters there for her, and where were you? So that's something I still don't have closure to. And I could have imagined the whole thing. Maybe it's just my perception. So I don't know if that's really a true thing. I wasn't really a witness to my dad's grief over my sister that I remember. I do remember walking in on my mom a couple times looking for her, and she'd be crying, and I say, "Mommy, why are you crying?" She said, "Oh, I was just thinking about Laura." And so I'd give her a hug. And just the fact that she was able to verbalize her grief to me in that short sentence gave me a lot of relief. I felt like my mom was taking care of herself. She was crying because she felt like crying. She didn't ask me to take care of her. I didn't have to take that on. It made me sad, but I felt like it probably started developing part of my personality at that point, because I think kids always look for what can I do to make things better. And I think for me, it was having a sense of humor. If I could make my mom laugh, if I could make my dad laugh, I was sort of became a clown. You know, I had a good natural sense of humor, but I think I really developed it to be that in the family. That was my part in the family dynamic.
So, you know, back in the 50s, and I would even say the 60s, it was very common to prescribe Valium to anyone, and I would say particularly women who were going through any kind of immense amount of feelings. Oh, you're having big feelings? Let's give
hysteria.
You some. Yeah, are you having some hysteria?
Give her a hysterectomy.
Yeah,
hysterectomy.
Yeah, we'll either give you a hysterectomy or Valium.
So yeah.
Your choice. Yeah. We can medicate, you know, it out of you. But sometimes, you know, that was something that women, you know, and I'm sure men as well, got addicted to, or they were on it a lot, but it also dulled a lot of their good feelings as well. So it was like the good feelings and the bad feelings also kind of get very neutralized. Do you know if your mom was ever prescribed Valium to get through that time?
I imagine so. I remember, yes, because the reason I can say that is I remember at my brother's funeral, I think my mom offered me a Valium, because that was probably how she got through my sister's funeral. And I didn't know what it was. And she said, "It just makes you kind of feel like you're not here." I said, "No, I think I want to feel this. I want to go through it." You know, I had my own ways of coping. I called on some good friends, and they took me out that evening, and I just wanted to be around people who weren't grieving. And that did not go well with my grandmother, but my parents were very supportive, and they said, "If this is how she grieves, that's what she needs to do. So that's kind of what I did after the funeral, but I've never taken Valium, so I'm not familiar with it, but I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, that was the era.
Right. You know? And no judgment. No judgment to anyone who is having to do the level of caregiving, grieving, loss, and all of that. I would never begrudge somebody something mm-hmm. that would help to make that more palatable in some way. So that was kind of your experience, like dealing with your parents going through some level of grief for a period of time. Did you ever feel a sense of like abandonment from 5 to whatever age? Did you ever feel like you were kind of just left to your own devices a little bit? Or,
you know, it's funny because I don't remember having a conscious feeling, because it's just like any other family. It's when you grow up in it, it's just your way of life. I didn't know that there would be any feelings to process. But if I look back with my mature eyes and I see my behavior showed that I did feel like I needed attention. I needed someone to pay attention to me. I would go to the mall because it was the one safe place that I could go and be independent. My mom could drop me off at the mall at 10 and I would just walk around and she'd come pick me up when I was done. And I would walk into all the stores and I would just talk to the merchants. I would ask them ridiculous questions just because they'd have to talk to me. They were paid to talk to me.
And you were 10.
Yeah.
So like, let's just think about that for a second. We have an 11-year-old. Mm-hmm. Okay. And our 11-year-old, and I understand that maybe times are different, right? There were things that I did at 10, 11 years old that we would probably not allow our son to do.
Sure.
But I would say that walking around a mall by yourself at 10 years old is pretty young.
My timeline might be off. So I don't want to go down that rabbit hole because I could have been 12.
Oh, maybe. I mean, maybe you could have.
But I remember being young. I remember being 10, 9, 10, 11 and sort of looking to my softball coaches for that connection with an older person that I must have been needing but I think we all kind of do that with coaches and mentors and things. But I remember kind of craving that, not knowing that there was anything missing, not feeling like there was anything missing, but my behavior, which if I look back, would show me. So when I got maybe old enough to go to the mall, maybe I was 12, I would go and have that experience. And looking back, I'm like, what a weird child I was. I was the only kid that would go to the mall and talk to merchants. You know, like my peers didn't do that. They went looking for boys or girls or their friends, or they'd go shopping for clothes. And I just wanted an adult to talk to me. So that probably is a symptom of something that I was feeling that I couldn't put my finger on. I wouldn't say that if I was in therapy, I would sit there and go, I was so neglected as a child. If you asked me at 10 what I thought, 16, 25, 35, and at 60, I can look back and go, well, with my mature eyes, my parents were amazing. You know, at 14, they didn't know anything, right? nobody understands me. And, you know, so which reality is right? You know, I can say that I did have symptoms of maybe not having the attention that a kid wanted to have at the time. And that changed with age. When I was a teenager, then I wanted attention from my peers.
I think that when we're older, we have a different level of compassion for our parents. We have a different level of empathy for our parents. I think that it is all true. It is all part of the reality of things.
Yeah, they're the facets on a diamond. And one's not more real than the other. It makes up the whole diamond, right?
But the imperfections of that diamond are also still there. Mm-hmm. And
it's part of what makes that diamond unique.
And it's okay, I think, to identify and look back on our lives and go, wow, I was 5 years old and making my own breakfast. Why was that? Well, probably because my parents were in a bad place, you know, like, so having some level of, I mean, not that that's what you were doing at 5 years old, making your own breakfast, but just looking back on things and going, well, that explains a lot about why I am the way I am today, or who, or why I feel, or why I get triggered, you know, because that's something that we talk about too, is like our triggers and things like that. Because I think it's really important to go back and say, well, you know what? If I was allowing our child to go and do something at an age that you felt was too young to do it, that might be a trigger for you. You might feel like that's me abandoning them in some way, or not giving them the same. Mm-hmm. So I think it's all really like important to explore that kind of stuff, because I think it does help us identify like the things that trigger us.
Mental health matters. Become a master's prepared psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner at Nightingale College. If you are an RN with a bachelor's degree in nursing, you can take the next step in a rewarding career move where you'll develop advanced knowledge and skills in assessment, intervention, and management within the construct of the psychiatric mental health patient-provider relationship and patient-centered care across the lifespan. This CCNE accredited program is now taking applications for the fall 2025 semester. For more information, please visit nightingale.edu or call 801-689-2160, because mental health matters.
So we've kind of touched on like what your experience was at the time of Laura's passing, how your parents coped in the aftermath of that, and how they then had to continue to care for your brother, who was also terminally ill. Did you feel, I mean, we've talked about this before, that as the healthy child, that you felt a certain responsibility in life. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I had never even heard the term survivor guilt until I was probably in my 20s. I didn't know what it was when my first therapist brought the word up. I'm like, what's that? And they explained it to me. It's interesting because being the youngest, John Bradshaw writes a series of books on birth order. And it's very interesting because as the youngest, I didn't have that oldest child kind of perfectionist, wanting to do really well, wanting to excel, feeling that pressure of almost being another parent because they have younger siblings, almost being a surrogate parent. I didn't have that. I didn't grow up with that dynamic. I was the youngest. I got taken care of. My brother took really good care of me too. He was kind of a surrogate parent. He was 10 years older than me, and we were very close. So I think he took that dynamic on. As a youngest child, I felt like my pressure I put on myself was not to excel in school or make a lot of money. It was more to be comic relief, which is why I was voted class clown as a senior in high school. That was my crowning achievement. I was not an academic. And I think that what developed in into my 20s and 30s was a workaholism. I became sort of a workaholic in the classic sense that I just said yes to everything. If someone said, do you want to go sliding down a snowy mountain on a surfboard? Yes, I've never done it. Yes. I just felt like I had to live for two people. Like I had to live and do everything my siblings never got to do. Travel, go all the places. I felt like they were seeing the world through my eyes. And like I carried them around like a backpack, I think, with me. And it brought me a lot of really amazing experiences. But where my life suffered was in my relationships with people. And it really, I was in six bands at one time, you know, and I was at a rehearsal every single night. And I was really happy. I mean, I loved playing music every night and having somewhere to go and having people to collaborate with. But it wasn't until my bandmate, and who's now like a sister to me, Johnny, took me aside and said, what are you doing? Like, what's going on? You know, she really let me have it in a really tough love kind of way. I think it was our drummer in our band. We were in a band together, Greg, and they were a couple at the time. It was his birthday, and true to form, I show up unprepared, not even really dressed for the party. totally forgetting to bring a present or a card. You know, just showing, just making an appearance.
Is this when you didn't have shoes on?
No, that was actually a bridal shower at a restaurant that I didn't have shoes on. Another moment that my dear friend Danny will be listening to this podcast going, yep, she showed up to my bridal shower at a restaurant with no shoes because I was so unfocused. I was not giving focus to the people in my life and the relationships and things that were part of my heart center. I was not allowing myself to have those intimate relationships. I had a lot of friends, but I didn't have intimate friends. And even though my friends would consider those intimate relationships, like, yeah, we've known each other for 40 years and we've been through all this together. Yes, we're close friends. At that time in my life, I was not at all nurturing those friendships. I was so busy living every, I almost couldn't sleep. It was really bad. Like I would get such little sleep because I just had to live. I had to be awake all the time to live. And there used to be a camp. Oh, well, I'll go back to the campaign I wanted to talk to you about. But Johnny had taken me aside and said, you know, it's Greg's birthday. We're throwing this big party. You show up late. You look like a mess. Now you're leaving early. Where are you going? Like, why are you always late from coming from somewhere and going somewhere? You're never here. What's going on? And that talk really made me go, my God, she's right. I'm never here. I'm never present. I'm only present when I'm like maybe playing music because I have to make my limbs work and I'm in a safe place and it's creative and no one's asking anything of me. I feel confident. I'm not having to connect on a love level or a heart level. So that conversation really made me take a good look at what I was doing. And I realized I'm living for people who aren't here anymore.
And I would also venture to say you had undiagnosed ADD.
Yes.
Which now we just call ADHD. It's just ADHD for everybody, even if you don't identify with the fact that maybe the hyperactivity side of it. But you, even as an adult, have ADD or ADHD. Mm-hmm. So I, as a child, you had it, but, you know, was this something, I mean, in that era, was that even something that people were talking about? Probably not.
Not unless I had hyperactivity. That was really being explored. I mean, with Ritalin and things, caffeine and things like that for mostly boys who were really, really hyperactive.
Right.
Then they kind of made that connection.
They didn't realize that for you just trying to focus, you know, which helps with academic success and all of those things, right? Just being able to be present as well. Like having that ability to like be in the moment, very difficult, I'm sure, very difficult for you at that time, unless like what you were saying, you were doing something creative or, you know, creating music, which does seem to kind of center you and bring you to the moment. So there's all that in addition to the fact that you're trying to live for all these people, but you're also, you know, kind of struggling with a brain chemistry that is making it really difficult.
Yeah, my report cards all say, tends to daydream, looks out the window, you know, can't focus on work, but tends to daydream was on so many of my report cards, and which lends itself to a creative life, which is fine, but to have to, but you know, I've never had trouble keeping a job, but I had creative jobs. All my jobs have always been forcing me to be in the moment. As you know, I used to be a sign language interpreter. The only time my mind ever could wander when I was a sign language interpreter was when the subject matter was so simple and I had gotten so fluent that I could actually think about, let's see, I got to do laundry when I get home. And I'm looking down at my hands and they're moving and I'm signing. I mean, you probably had that experience too. When you get to a certain point, you can, but you know, that's not that often. Often you're doing a lecture with really difficult vocabulary, difficult subject matter. You're interpreting on a college level. You can't daydream. You have to be focused, which is why one of the reasons I really loved that job. And then I became a Foley artist where I had to, when that red light went on, I was in record. I had to perform. I had to be on. There is no sitting at a desk going, I guess I'll get to that task later. You know, there's no procrastinating. You have a certain amount of work to do in a certain time. So had I not found those jobs, I would not have done well in other sectors because of the ADHD. It was a perfect fit for workaholism because, right, my heart needed me to not be close to people, distract myself, busy myself, and live for these people who have passed on. And the ADHD was the perfect fit, right, for that. So the perfect storm. There was a campaign for, was it Bodies in Motion, I think, one of the gyms, and it said, you can rest when you're dead. And that billboard was everywhere, and it haunted me. It haunted me to the point where I went, I want that t-shirt, because that was the only thing that ever was reflected in my world that reflected how I felt inside. That is exactly how I felt. I can rest when I'm dead. That was a mantra I would not purposely say to myself, but it was like a voice telling me, when you die, you can rest like everybody else. But for now, you don't get to rest. You are living for everybody, you know?
Yep.
But it also, you know, it created a gap between me and my parents too. You know, my parents were still alive. I certainly didn't probably make time for them or my friends in my life. I was just too busy being in my head, running away from stuff.
So, okay. I'm going to pull you out of your immediate family. And now I'm going to drop you into our relationship 13 years ago. Okay. At the very, very beginning. Now, you are now with a woman who works at the very hospital where your siblings passed away.
Where I grew up. I spent a lot of time
grew
there.
Grew up yeah. at this hospital. Mm-hmm. Okay. And is this a coincidence? I don't know. Is this the universe providing some opportunity for healing? Possibly. But I worked in a position where I was taking care of children who were very sick, pediatric oncology. I worked in the solid tumor area at the time and experienced a lot of death, a lot of suffering, a lot of loss, a lot of grief, a lot of death. And a lot of times nurses will want to come home and in some way decompress by talking to their partner about what they are experiencing at work. This was difficult for you and I. I knew that if I brought this to you, this was going to bring up a certain level of trauma for you. At the same time, I didn't know how to process that without being able to talk to my partner. That was a really difficult experience for both of us. What was that like? What was that like for you, me coming home and talking about children dying?
Well, I feel like since being with you for 13 years, meeting so many nurses, traveling and meeting nurses, doing this podcast, I understand what nurses in general need from their partners much more than I did then. I did not understand what nurses needed. So what it was like for me was you'd come home with stories about people, you know, I can't remember the name of that disease where the flesh just peels off and you
epidermolysis bullosa.
Horrible, horrible, horrible stories. And it was like listening to, and this is where we can all have empathy for and awareness for nurses. It was like listening to someone coming home from war every single day. When people go off to war, they're gone for years. Sometimes they write letters to their spouses and they come home and either stuff it, medicate it, maybe get therapy and get help. But they're not coming home every day going, yeah, so my best friend got his arm blown off. And what happened was and the spouse having to hear the war stories. So it was hearing war stories all the time and not understanding why. I mean, very graphic. So, and for me, not understanding why you would bring that home to me. Because in my mind, I didn't sign up to be a nurse. I didn't sign up to be a veterinarian surgeon either. There are certain things I don't rescue, you know, abused animals. There are things I can't handle in this world. God bless all of you who do this, because the weaker people like me, I'm sorry, but there's, you know, people like me, and which is not to say that nurses aren't sensitive. They're sensitive people. They do it anyway. Where would we be without people to take care of us and see all this stuff? We can't protect nurses from what they see. But in my mind, I'm like, why can't you protect me? I didn't go into this field. I don't want to hear about it. I didn't understand your need to decompress. To me, it felt like it felt insensitive. Like, well, look, this is what you chose as a profession. Call your nurse friends and talk to them about it because they can handle it. I felt like I couldn't handle it. I just felt like I wasn't built that way. And because I didn't understand what was happening for you, what that benefit was for you, I just felt like you were bringing pain home to me that I didn't ask for. So that's how it felt to me.
Yeah, I mean, that was a very difficult time. And, you know, eventually I ended up leaving that specific profession, not necessarily for that reason, but I think that we had this very kind of unique dynamic where you had a very, very specific relationship to the very place that I worked. Mm-hmm. And maybe other partners, other spouses feel like they can do that. But in our situation, you couldn't. You just couldn't. And you know, resented me a little bit for, you know, bringing that kind of pain to you. The fact that I would paint pretty graphic images of what I was experiencing at work, I think was the only way that I felt like I could get you to understand where I was, what was going on for me, that you could potentially understand why I was feeling the way I was feeling or why I was acting the way I was acting or why I seemed maybe depressed or distant or detached or, you know, any number of things was because I felt like, well, certainly if you understand, if I can paint this picture for you, you'll understand what I'm going through. And so we were in this like kind of dance, right? Like of me feeling like I needed to really, really explain the level of trauma that I was experiencing as a nurse. And you were in this place of, I can't see that. That is just, I can't picture that in my head. I do not want to have this visualization in my head. And it took us a long time to navigate all of that. And I'm sure that the listeners to this podcast are having a similar experience with their partners. You know, maybe not to the degree that you and I did because of your history and, you know, the strange coincidence of me working at the same hospital where you lost your siblings and where you spent most of your life. So you coming to visit me at work is not the same as probably another spouse going to visit their partner at work. It just brings a different level of weight. There's just a different weight to it. Mm-hmm. So how all of this has played into your life, you know, whether it's through your family dynamics, whether it's through how you've operated in the world and chosen to work, the relationships with your friends, the relationships, your romantic relationships, all of it, all of this has played a part, you know, in that, which is, I think, a really important takeaway from this episode is allowing people to look at their life a little bit through that lens and seeing how trauma and grief and loss plays into all the different aspects of their life.
Yeah, and I appreciate the work that people are doing to help siblings of chronically ill children find their own place and have things that are just theirs.
Super Sibs.
Just belong to them.
Super Sibs is a great example.
Mm-hmm. And thank God because we forget about them because they're the healthy ones. Like my mom always says, you never needed anything. You were always so independent. And I think—
Which was her perspective of you.
Right.
But you did, I mean, you were a child, you did need things. You were sick at times and needed that kind of comfort and love and care. And, you know, even just that perspective of you were always fine, you know, has its own consequences.
Yeah, I remember getting, it must have been foot, what do they call it? The foot and mouth?
Oh, I'm guessing.
hand, sores, foot, and mouth, all in your. Yeah. So I was about 16 or 17 and I had high fever and I couldn't get it. My body felt like it weighed 300 pounds. I couldn't get out of bed. I think I got out of bed for water a couple times, but I don't remember coming out of my room for 3 days. I missed school. And I remember years later, I said, I don't know if you remember this, Mom, but I was so sick. Why didn't you take me to the doctor? I mean, it had sores all in my mouth that were blistering and then breaking, and I'm constantly spitting and trying to get to the bathroom. And she said, well, you never complain. So I didn't know how sick you were. And I think that in my, you know, I have this perception in my house that if you weren't dying, you know, which is why when I cut my finger last month and you bandaged it up, and I probably, you know, yes, I think anybody else would have gone for stitches, but in my family, I nearly cut my thumbs off a couple times and they literally wrapped it up and they're like, you'll be fine. So that's my perception, is you just wrap yourself up. And my mom would cut herself, you know, cutting vegetables, and she'd be bleeding all over the kitchen, and she would just be like, I'm fine. Put a towel on it. Keep going, because the onions need to be done, you know?
Yeah.
She was just a tough, gentle soul, but tough, you know? Like I just felt like there was nothing that my mom couldn't handle.
And I think that that's what you value in other people.
I do value that.
I think that you really tend to value that kind of strength and, you know, independence and in other people, and that, you know, anything other than that may be weak or considered some level of weakness. Yeah. So, you know, but also just very important to understand. I think this is why it's so important to look at our life and understand why we see the world the way we see it, and be able to communicate that. Mm-hmm. To people we're dating, to friends, to family, so that they understand us better and can connect with us on a different level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would say the same for, you know, nurses aren't all one entity, right? All nurses have their own needs, but I would say if a nurse can get a hold of what is it that I need from my partner. Not necessarily that I need to tell you the story in graphics or something, but I need you to know what I've been through. And I want to tell you from my heart what this feels like. I think it's an easier lift for the partner to go, I want to hear what you've been through. I may not be able to hear the details. And then the partner needs to be able to go, how can I be there for my spouse? How can I, one, muster up the strength that I don't think I have, maybe be a little stronger for them? Try to understand what is it that you're actually needing from me and how can I give it to you? Because nurses need to have that strong partner at home for them. They have to be strong all day long. And when they get home, they may or may not want to be pampered. They may want to be left alone. They may want to talk for a few hours about their day. And I think that it's really important for those of us who are partners to nurses that we ask, what can I do? Not assume you know what your partner needs. Your partner may not need you to draw them a bath, but they might need something else, and asking them on a day-to-day basis.
And it's important for us as nurses to also understand that the stuff that we see, sometimes we get a little bit desensitized in a way. And so it is important to ask our partners, you know, are you in a place to hear what I am about to tell you right now? Or is there another time or place? Or do I need to make an appointment with a therapist? Because I've got some stuff I need to get out, or I need to decompress, or maybe I need to write about it or something until my partner's in a place to hear what I experienced. But I think it's both ways, right? Like the part, you know,
we have to work together.
Yeah, a spouse needs to be able to ask, what do you need as you come home from this shift and what can I do to help? But additionally, us asking of our partner what we need, being proactive about that and seeing if our partner is in a position to hear the stuff that we have to share. So, well, babe.
Well, as your producer, we're out of time.
We are out of time. It has now been a full hour. And
Don't worry, honey.
I know you will. I know you will. You are awesome. I wouldn't have this podcast without you. Nurse.com would not have this podcast without you. You are phenomenal. You are a great partner, a great wife.
Thank you, honey.
And I'm really, really grateful that you took the time to share your story with me and with all of our listeners.
Well, thank you for listening and for the wonderful questions. And thank you for Nurse.podcast because I love working on it and I love listening to it. I've learned so much from all the wonderful nurses that have been on this show and other guests. And to all the nurses out there, I cannot express enough love from my heart. Having lived 13 years with a nurse and meeting so many of you, I'm so grateful that you are in this world. And I vow to work with my wife, Kara, to make things better as best as they can be for nurses.
Thank you so much, babe.
Love you.
Love you. If you're a nurse or nursing student that enjoyed this episode, visit us at nurse.com/community, where you can find the Nurse.Dot discussion group, a place where we dissect each episode in detail and delve deeper into today's topics. Nurse Dot is a Nurse.com original podcast series. Production, music, and sound editing by Dawn Lunsford. Production coordination by Rhea Wade. Additional editing by John Wells. Thank you to all the listeners for tuning in to the Nurse Dot podcast. Until next time, keep spreading the love and the care.